It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In the past year, since our guest, Mayor Bill Peduto, began making his monthly appearances on our program, we have talked a great deal about police-community relations. Now that Pittsburgh is one of six cities chosen for a new pilot program in that area, we get to take the conversation one step further. Mayor Peduto is with us again today to discuss this and other issues, including his meeting with President Obama last week. Mayor Peduto, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm doing good. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to Pittsburgh.
Happy birthday to Pittsburgh.
It was what? I'll let you do the grand proclamation here.
Yeah. So 199 years ago today, the good folks in the city of Harrisburg granted unto the people of Pittsburgh the right to be a city. Prior to that, we were Pittsburgh, with the Scottish spelling, which is why we have the H still. And instead of having a mayor, we had a Burgess. And 199 years later, we now have a mayor and a councilman Burgess.
Right. So that clears up, I think, a lot of what may be confusing for people, because Pittsburgh has been around for 250 years.
Well, the British taking over from the French in the first actual World War, because they loved us so much they fought all over the world for us, actually occurred over 250 years ago. At that point, Fort Pitt was established, named after the Prime Minister of England. And at that point, though, it was still a colony and part of the Great Britain. And then after the Revolutionary War, we were a borough. We were established, and they created back in the 1780s a downtown road system with two conflicting grids that don't really work out too well, and which we still have today. And in 1816, when the number of people exceeded the number of deer, we lobbied Harrisburg, and might I say successfully, which is kind of hard to do these days, but we were able to become a city. And in July, I think it was July 16th of 1816, a bunch of folks got together down on 4th Avenue, and they selected Ebenezer Denny to be the first mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, who was a Revolutionary War hero who fought at the Battle of Yorktown when Cornwallis surrendered. And if you ever watch the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson, when he's leaning over the musket and pulling that flag out that his son had sewed back together, and there's a soliloquy which goes something like, "The only sound I could hear on the battlefield was the sound of the drummer boy, the most beautiful sound I ever heard in my life, Ebenezer Denny." Well, that's our Ebenezer. And by the way, Ebenezer Denny, great name for a schnauzer.
And are you saying that from personal experience?
No, I just thought about that.
I thought maybe you had a schnauzer but when you get one, you'll name it.
I really want to get a Boston Terrier and name it Penelope Barker, who is also a Revolutionary War figure, but yes.
You just don't run into many people named Ebenezer anymore.
No, you don't.
So we have to find a way to bring it back.
Well, we're at 199. Next year is the 200th anniversary, and we should put out that decree to anybody who's thinking about starting a family next year to bring back old Ebenezer.
There you go. And when we get, we'll save it for the end of the show, the details, some of which were put out there today about what's in store, what's being about what's being planned for the 200th anniversary celebration. A committee is being formed, as they say.
The committee was announced today on the birthday to let folks know that we are planning on doing some stuff. 100 years ago, Mayor Armstrong, Joe the Builder, they called him, he put together the plan to build the city-county building. If I put together a plan to build a new city-county building, they'd bring back the stockade and put me in Market Square. So instead of doing something that just is, spending money we don't have, we're going to be reaching out to the community and find 200 different ways to celebrate and being able to do it in a lot of different unique ways that really celebrate us being us.
And maybe before the end of the show, we can solicit one or two from our listeners. And
that would be great.
Yeah, we could save that for the end because our production team is already scrambling for special music.
Yeah.
Per your request. So we don't want to spoil the surprise. So we'll save that for the All end right. of the show. But much to get to between now and then. And I referred at the top of the segment to the initiative. announced by Attorney General Eric Holder, designed to repair police community relations. Pittsburgh, one of the six cities chosen to be a part of this pilot project. Explain how it works and how Pittsburgh became a part of it.
Well, Pittsburgh became part of it, really, I have to give a lot of credit to, first off, our chief, Cam McClay, who applied for this. He had the personal experience of working with Dr. David Kennedy before. And as you may know, Dr. Kennedy has put together these community police relations programs in other cities that have a proven, trackable, quantifiable record of reducing violent crime. Dr. Kennedy was in Pittsburgh for a minute back several years ago and left, stating that it was the least cooperative police force that he had ever encountered in the United States.
Why wouldn't the force cooperate with him at that time?
It was a culture. It was a culture that the police should not have outside organizations or people saying what needs to be done in Pittsburgh, that we know how to do it ourselves, that we have unique situations that require the experience and the knowledge of years of working in Pittsburgh to be able to do it, and that these other types of methods may work in cities like Providence, Rhode Island, or Boston, or New York, or countless cities across the country, but they're not going to work here.
What I've heard is that this – some have said this is the kind of program that helps prevent Pittsburgh from becoming the next Ferguson.
This is the type of program that gets to the root of why we have situations that erupt between police and community. It doesn't happen just because an incident occurs. It happens because there was nothing there beforehand to be able to take it to a much lower level when an incident does occur. Let's be real fair and open about this. Incidents are going to occur. Police are dealing with violent people. Police are dealing with dysfunction. And they're dealing with situations that don't follow rules. And in those cases, there are always going to be times when force is necessary. But how it is used and making sure that it doesn't exceed the escalation is something that we work now to train our officers on. But it's still going to happen. But, you know, when Chief McClay came in, he asked each of his commanders at his first commander's meeting, send me the list of people when that incident occurs that you call. And there wasn't lists. There were no lists. So over the course of the first month, starting to put together a list of community leaders, of who in the community that you call to say, hey, look, this happened. There's going to be a lot of questions that are coming. We're going to be in getting information out. Recently, when violent crimes have been occurring at Homewood, one of the newspapers had reported that we're doing saturation patrols. And we are, but we're doing it in a different way. We're not pulling everybody over. What we're doing is we're going up to the neighbors' doors and knocking on them and saying, are you okay? Is there anything that you need? Is there anything you'd like to talk about? And building that one-to-one relationship back with the police and the community so that when that incident does occur, that there's a trust and a communication and a chain already in place between police and community. So we've been selected as one of six cities to bring in the experts from around the country to help us to look first at benchmarking where we're at today, and then what steps can be taken in order to be able to improve our situation. The great thing about it is being a city that's as large as Pittsburgh but as small as Pittsburgh, we have the real opportunity to be able to do something great that could become a model around the country. So Chief McClay realized that. He applied for this early on when he first came in. He worked on the relationships that he had across the country. He's recognized internationally as an expert on police administration and also on community policing, and then worked hand-in-hand with our U.S. Attorney, David Hickton. And David Hickton, working through the U.S. Department of Justice, assured that we were one of the cities selected.
I'm guessing that you would be inclined to agree that there's no panacea here. How confident are you, though, that this program can contribute significantly to Pittsburgh solving its problems in the area of police community relations?
I think if we would have tried this several years ago, we would have been facing a lot more obstacles, and certainly the obstacles that Dr. Kennedy faced. It's not just bringing in a new police chief. We have an entire new command staff, all the way from two of the three assistant chiefs to most of the commanders, to new lieutenants and new sergeants throughout. We promoted from within. We found those officers that, based upon the merit, have been waiting for the types of promotion and that type of responsibility. And there's a willingness all the way from the very, very top to see this work. So I think that the opportunity's there. I think that the willingness is there. I guess it still, you know, needs to be proven. So we'll have the course of the next 3 years. There's a little over $1 million that will be coming into Pittsburgh. But that's only pennies compared to the dollars of the expertise that will be given through in-kind services that will be given to us as well.
And a programming note that tomorrow we'll be discussing the National Initiative to Build Community Trust with Pitt Law Professor David Harris, who has studied these issues extensively. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Mayor Peduto is here with us today. For the entire hour, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002 if you have a comment or a question for Mayor Peduto, and we're going to be hitting a number of issues today. Referring back to what we were talking about earlier in the area of police-community relations, it was suggested in a Post-Gazette piece that it wouldn't be a bad idea for the police here to do something like what the Jackson County, Missouri Sheriff's Department did, and that was handing out $100 bills to people driving dented cars, or a coupon for free pizza to somebody who was, you know, making sure that they, even though the snow was piled up, that they were crossing in the, getting to the crosswalk and crossing there. The piece suggested that this would be a way to kind of turn people's perceptions of the police on their heads a little bit. And you tweeted that something about the op-ed that I'm referring to. What do you think of this?
I saw that story. It was right around Christmas time. And if you haven't seen it, it's just remarkable because people get pulled over. And the first reaction, they put down their window and they're angry. And they're like, I stopped at that stop sign. And then the officer said, well, I just wanted to pull you over to wish you a Merry Christmas or whatever it was that they'd say. And they hand them a $100 bill and people cried. The drivers would cry because it's shock from, you know, the one person's on the cell phone going, you know, I'm telling them right now, and they're ready to fight. And then they'll say, like, my kids weren't going to have Christmas this year. You just gave them Christmas. And, you know, boom. That type of a reaction has a way of doing a lot of good. I think we can find sponsors in the city to start to do that. I like it was another police force which rewarded people for good behavior. In that article, they talked about the person that walked a half block down the street to go to the corner so they weren't jaywalking, waited till it turned to walk. They walked across. The officer stopped them and gave them a coupon to, you know, for the free pizza or whatever it is. We have brought back the police sports league, and having kids having the opportunities to play against police officers on a basketball court is a lot better way than interaction on a street. These are all the ways. And the funny thing about it, you know, whether it's walking a beat, whether it's our officers who are on bikes in the neighborhood, you just go back. This is the old model of policing when you think about, like, you know, Car 54, when you think about Mayberry. You know, I mean, when you think about, like, those types of times, and when you go into communities where there are elders in the Hill District and in Homewood, and you ask people who are in their 70s or even older, what do you remember about police relations? They can tell you the name of the officer when they were in high school. And that's really where it begins.
You bring up a very, very interesting, salient point here. And you mentioned, you know, you mentioned those old TV shows, and you mentioned Andy Griffith, and you can say that those notions, those values in shows like that are antiquated, but I'm thinking back to an episode of Andy Griffith where he is being brought up on charges for using a police vehicle, for inappropriate personal activity, which in this particular episode happened to be that he was helping a woman take her groceries home. She was struggling with the bags walking down the street, and he gives her a ride. I mean, these kinds of things that may be against regulations, but that are the common sense thing to do. Is that the thing that the police have to look at now to as a way of earning back community trust and just of relating to people in a more real way than simply going by the book and
it's
what that tells them to do?
So it's already happening. I got an email from somebody right around Thanksgiving, and it was we were doing a saturation in East Liberty on this back street that was having a lot of activity. And officers would, you know, drive down, people would disperse, they'd leave, they'd come back, people would disperse. And, you know, you're not getting rid of the crime, it's just moving. But one time the officer came down, there was a girl, a little girl, who whose bike was broken. And he stopped, he went back in his trunk, pulled out some tools, sat there for like 30 minutes and fixed her bike. And this
That's
person
great.
Wrote me an email and just said, you know, how blown away she was because they did that. I think officers do it a lot more. It doesn't get reported. It doesn't get talked about. But when someone sees it, they remember it. You don't have to tell them to do it. 90% of them will already do it. They do it on a constant basis. Just got to be able, that same way of getting the free pizza to the person that does the good thing, we got to find a way to reward our officers for doing it as well. Been talking to the firefighters lately, the union. We just got that deal done about creating in certain neighborhoods where we have both a ladder and engine, and where we have at least enough equipment where we can get somebody offline for a little while, in places like Homewood, again, to be able to create what we call a walking school bus, where parents can safely walk their children to a corner where a firefighter will be standing there, and then they will walk them to school. And that builds the trust at a very early age. Maybe a little kid looks up to them and says, I want to be a firefighter. But at the same time, you know, that firefighter is engaging with the community in a real way. You have Faison right down the street. That's very, you know, where we have the stations and we have the schools, connecting them both together. And there's a lot of ways. But again, we're going back to the basics. That's, you know, we're not looking. We're using technology. Don't get me wrong. We've got a police chief who is really focused in on that and using it to lessen crime and to be able to catch the bad guys faster. But so much of it really harkens back to the past.
We're on with Mayor Peduto here on Essential Pittsburgh. Lots of people waiting to join the conversation at 412-246-2002. We will get to all of you. We do need to take a break, so why don't we do that now? It is Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer on 90.5 WESA. Tony. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are visiting with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, as we do each and every month at this time. You can join our conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. And again, our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number, 412-246-2002. We've been talking about police community relations issues, among other things. And let's go to Jimmy in Brownsville, who has a question or comment. Jimmy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, Jimmy. Are you there?
Mayor, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Now we can. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, Paul. You, the mayor, do you read the city paper? Now, I'm over 60. I call it a weekly underground paper. You guys read that paper?
Yes, we do, or I do. I'm sure the mayor does as
when
well.
When I get time, I certainly do.
They wrote about you a couple of weeks ago, Mayor.
Yeah,
You're on the cover of the newspaper.
I kept a copy for my mom. She didn't like the
okay,
picture.
Okay, so here, I don't want to embarrass you now, but they did a scathing report. You weren't mayor yet, about Jordan Miles. Now, let me walk you through this. Everybody knows what happened to Jordan Miles. What we didn't know is when the city paper did an investigative report, The three knuckleheads that jumped him did it 6 months earlier to a black guy named Johnson. His attorney was named O'Brien. The city settled out of court. I don't know if you know anything about this, Mayor. They settled out of court. They did the same thing to Jordan Miles, but nobody came forward to it. And according to the city paper, those three guys always lie on their police reports. Their division commander allows them to do what they want to do. And my question to you is, are those, you guys gave them plaques and medals. You gave these two idiots plaques and medals for what they did to Jordan Miles. Well,
hey,
everybody in that department, according to city paper, knew that these three guys were dirty. And I got one more follow-up.
Jimmy, let me jump in. Let me just jump in because I'm not sure if all of that. And I'll let the mayor try and respond as best he can. But, again, these were things that happened before he took office. Mayor, whatever you have in terms of a response here.
Well, I can tell you that there were a number of cases that came through city council on civil rights violations between the years of 2007 and 2013, and we're still going through several of them right now that really, I guess, point to a bigger issue than just the incidents themselves. And, again, this comes down to the proper training, the proper oversight, and treating that culture that we're trying to create within the Bureau. As far as the case before that, I don't know anything about it. I do know that it was last year that the courts finally ended on the Jordan Miles case, and I believe there was around $100,000 settlement through the courts involving a false arrest. But the civil complaints and the civil trials, and I don't know if there were any criminal trials, but they never really proved that those incidents were at that level.
And the issue that was at the heart of this is that what was reported was that when these plainclothes officers pulled up and identified themselves as police, Jordan Miles was scared and ran. And this speaks to the issue of, and regardless of whether that was the right or wrong thing to do, and most people would tell you that when the police tell you to stop, you have to stop. But that being said, this speaks to the issue of the trust between police and members of the community, particularly members of the African-American community, minorities, many of whom simply do not trust the police. And that if you can bridge that gap, you might get better cooperation.
Yeah. And, that's, I'm not trying to say that, this isn't something that I own. I was on council. Certainly had opportunities and responsibilities, but I can tell you that even as mayor, I know that some point during these 4 years, there's going to be an incident. I mean, it's inevitable within the number of situations that occur and the amount of violence that is a part of that, that something doesn't go wrong at some point. And it's how we handle it from that point. What have we done? Well, we got a new solicitor, somebody who comes with a federal prosecuting background who prosecuted cocaine dealers in Miami in the 80s. We have a new head of OMI who has over 20 years as a University of Pittsburgh police officer and was the chair of the Citizens Police Review Board. We have a new police chief who comes from the outside, the first police chief ever brought in from outside the force, who is recognized as a leader on training. And the entire system of internal investigation has been taken away from public safety and placed under law. So the entire structure, and even a new public safety director who comes from FBI, who the reason I brought him in is I said I needed Elliot Ness, and I brought in a guy whose integrity and ability to make sure we're doing the right things is there. So when that situation does occur, I feel I have the team around us to make sure that the people's rights will be upheld.
Let's go to Matt in Bloomfield. Matt, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Mayor Peduto.
Hi, how's it going? I have two quick questions. My first one is regarding the new police chief. I recently saw him on the local television show Night Talk, and they were having a little roundtable discussion, and the topic of stop and frisk came up, and the police chief seemed to have some favorable things about to say about stop and frisk, and suggested that it might be a useful tool for for the police force to use. And I think that might be a little bit antithetical when we're having this conversation about building, you know, trust between communities and the police. I was just curious what the mayor might have to comment about that.
Sure, Matt. And it's an issue that obviously is being discussed around the country. New York, having banned it, looking now to possibly bring it back. The operation of field investigations, which fall under search and seizure of part of the Constitution, is a, if there's a suspected activity or there's believed to be a gun involved or there's believed to be drugs involved, the officer has the right to do a field inspection without having to go to a judge to get a warrant and then try to find that person again. In communities that we have the most violent crime, where we have guns all over the streets, people want us to get the guns off the street. A field investigation is a necessary part in order to be able to do that. To simply say that should never happen is only going to escalate the amount of people who are dying. It doesn't help the situation of dealing with violent crime to completely eliminate field investigations. But what has to happen is there have to be very strict rules in place that not only the police know, but the community at large knows as well. And those rules need to be followed. And what we did, Councilman Burgess, a couple of years ago, put together rules that the police bureau must do. How many field investigations are happening in the city of Pittsburgh? Break it down by race. Break it down by location. And then present that information back to the public so that they can see when and how we are instituting field investigations. That being said, that hadn't been done in the past. Now with a new chief in place and he putting together not only a chief of staff in his office but also technology experts in his office, we'll not only be able to give that information back to the public so they can see how we're using this important part of policing, but you'll be able to see it on a map and be able to download it right off the city's website.
So you're saying that we can have things like stop and frisk, but that there needs to be transparency. There needs to be more in the way of full disclosure about how it's being done.
Correct. And it has to happen in a situation where there is believed to be a weapon or drugs or something else that is a harm to a community. That officer shouldn't have to go back and get a search warrant in order to be able to do that if it's an immediate concern that it needs to be done. But at that same time, that information needs to be made to the public so the public can be able to not only, you know, it's not just for punitive purposes to be able to say, aha, you're only doing it in this one neighborhood, but to be able to see what is happening. I mean, the use of data in determining police activity and what it's needed is so far beyond cops on dots. You know, that was the decade ago where you'd be able to basically put down where have all the gunshots occurred and where has all the violent crime occurred, put a dot on it, and then put a police officer there. It is a three-dimensional network that can be basically branched out, and you can start to track these things. And by eliminating this one bar and by going with a parole officer and finding that person who is not supposed to be out but is dealing drugs and taking them, you start to collapse networks of crime, and you start to make neighborhoods safer.
Let's go to Joe in Tarentum. Joe, you're on with Mayor Peduto. We lost Joe. He had a good question. We'll go to hello? Did I hear somebody? I'm hearing voices. Tony in Allison Park, are you there?
How you guys doing today?
Is this Tony?
Yes, this is Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I was just calling because I was wondering why the city doesn't allow county residents to work for the firefighters. Is it purely union issues? And if ever, when would they free that up to county residents?
Tony, it's actually a state law. the state had, I guess the union years ago, had gone to Harrisburg and said that they wanted to be able to recruit from within the city, and the state legislators said, okay. Certainly, we could find a lot of volunteer fire departments and also a lot of professional firefighters from around Allegheny County that would love to be a part of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Fire. This is something that I've talked to the unions about before, but until we can get them to support us in Harrisburg, we're going to be fishing from a small pool.
Thank you for that question, Tony. I wanted to ask about where things stand with the body cameras for the Pittsburgh police. In your 2015 budget proposal to City Council, you shifted about $650,000 to pay for 1,000 body cameras for the Pittsburgh police. When will the cameras go into use? What kind of impact do you see them having?
Well, this goes back also to the U.S. Department of Justice grant that we're getting and the help that will be provided. You know, the story's still not out on body cameras. I mean, obviously, they have the benefit of providing a better picture of a he said, she said situation that could benefit both the person involved in it and the police officer themselves. However, in the state of Pennsylvania, unlike most states, we have a two-party requirement, a set sign-off, before you can enter into somebody's house with a recording device, which means that once our officers are in a pursuit or once our officers are getting a call of a domestic, the moment that they cross into that home, if they don't have the permission of that person, they have to turn off their camera. And then what happens in there becomes speculation. Why'd you turn off your camera? What happened? And we go back to that situation. So we're working in Harrisburg to change that, and we're trying to work with ACLU in order to be able to not have much objection to this, since this is something that's done in other places. And what we need to also be very cognizant about is when an officer is in that situation, we've been having very detailed conversations. The public safety director, the chief of police, our city solicitor, chief of staff Kevin Ackland, myself. The last thing that the officer needs to be thinking about when they're in a pursuit is my camera on or is my camera off? Because that instant takes away from their thought process of what they've been trained to do and how they handle that situation. So how we pursue that as well. There aren't cameras in place, which I was surprised to find, that are on 24 hours. You know, that was my assumption, is you just leave it on all the time and problem solved. But that's not the case. So, you know, we may be able to pursue some additional help to be able to find out, as we're going down the path of getting the state law changed, of how and when it is appropriate, and this would be third party, for the cameras to be turned off, what the policies would be, and also protecting people's privacy at the same time. There's too many open-ended questions to simply strap a camera on an officer and put them out there without jeopardizing the civil liberties of the people and potentially putting the officer at harm's way. We're still committed to it. We have the funding in place. We've talked with the White House about the grant program that they're proposing, but we have to do our homework on the front end first.
Let's go to Chrissy in Gibsonia. Chrissy, you're on with Mayor Peduto.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Chrissy.
Hi. I'm calling from Gibsonia, but I'd like to talk about my grandfather and about the way that community interaction worked, you know, with the police officers, you know, back in the day. My grandfather lived in and walked the beat in Hazelwood, and he died in 1962, so that this is a good bit of time ago. But when he walked his beat, if he would come upon a man who was, you know, drunk and maybe disorderly, a man or two, instead of taking them to jail, he would take them to his home. Wow. And let them sleep it off, you know, in his basement. And then in the morning, you know, they were free to go home. And in the summertime, my grandfather and several of his sisters owned a farm in Zelianople. And he would take any of these guys up, you know, who were willing to work on his farm for the summer. And I'm not sure, you know, what he paid them, but they did honest work, and they got to eat the good food that my grandmother prepared. Hmm. And I guess, you know, this is the way that he did good things for the community.
Chrissy, thank you for sharing that story. That is part of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police legacy. That's something that we're working every day, and our officers are working every day to bring back.
Thanks, Chrissy. Let's go to Don in Pittsburgh. Don, you're on with the mayor. How are you?
Very good. Mayor, thank you very much for taking my call, and also people in Pittsburgh ought to appreciate this kind of access. The purpose of my question is about the youth and high unemployment in inner-city neighborhoods. And I always thought that the best way that you could really get a lot of people to work and keep them working was do what the unions do with commercial projects downtown, whereby they use the labor stabilization agreements. Why can't there be a residential labor stabilization agreement applied in inner cities? And I think that would be a good source of employment, a steady source of employment with all the work you're doing. And I was hoping somebody could ever implement something like that.
Thank you.
It's a great, great question, great point you brought up, Don.
Yeah. So part of it, Don, that we're trying to do is create a similar type program, but doing it at the neighborhood level. So we're working with nonprofits in neighborhoods around the city and for-profit developers as well, where we're starting to look, instead of just building these big apartment buildings for affordable housing, looking to restore the homes that are already there, putting the money into it, and then hiring people from the neighborhood to help us to restore them through these nonprofit organizations. So somebody's not just getting a job doing drywall. They're learning how to do drywall. They're learning how to hang a window. They're learning how to do plumbing. They're learning how to do electrical. And house by house, we're restoring the neighborhood. And the person that's moving in isn't renting. They're putting equity into it over the long term to be able to own it. So it's a encompassing way to do what you're doing. A couple other things we were doing. When we took office last year, we had about 180 kids every summer that were involved in our summer youth program, and that's where we actually give them a job over the summer. We doubled that last year, so we had nearly 400 kids. And this summer, well, the problem was we had 400 kids, but we had 1,300 kids apply. So 900 kids, we had to say, sorry, we don't have anything for you. So this summer, we've been partnering with a lot of different corporations, Allegheny County, even Jerome Bettis, and we're going to hire 2,000 kids. So we're taking it from 200 to 2,000 in the course of a little less than 2 years. We're going to give those kids the opportunity to work in offices, to go and work on college campuses so that they can see it and dream it and be a part of it and think, this is where I'm going to go to college. And then for the kids in college, we've yesterday launched the city's first internship program, and we're going to hire 100 college kids to work in city government and in City Hall, give them an opportunity to put something on their resume, give them an opportunity to see what it's like, give them an opportunity to earn college credits over the summer and maybe make a little bit of money. And if they're not making a little bit of money through that job, give them enough time to work a second job to be able to go back to school the next semester.
I wish that was around when I was a kid. That's a great program.
Yep.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some of your Twitter questions and more calls. And Mr. Peduto goes to Washington as Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, telling some tales out of school here in the break. Yeah, that not for broadcast. Yeah. We're with Mayor Phil Peduto here on Essential Pittsburgh, and we were talking about your trip to Washington for the National League of Cities Congressional City Conference, and you had a chance to speak with President Obama. One of the things that came up during that conversation, I guess, was the driverless car being developed at CMU that produces its own energy. Talk about this conversation you had with the president.
Well, the invitation itself came the night before. I'm sitting at a dinner and I get an email. It says, if you're receiving this email, you have been asked to welcome the president to the National League of Cities Conference. And I'm thinking, oh, that's great. And I get in and at the front right, there's about 50 mayors of the major cities. And I'm seated next to my friend Betsy Hodges of Minneapolis, and we're about row 8, and somebody grabs my name off the chair when they saw me, and they said, please follow me, and they take me up, and they put me in row 1, and I'm sitting next to the head of government affairs for the White House, Jerry Abramson, former mayor of Indianapolis, of Louisville, Kentucky, and in the front row, it's all the officers of the National League of Cities. And I'm like, oh, so it's not going to be 50 of us. I wonder how many. And it ended up being 15. And they took the 15 of us with Secret Service and put us in a different room, and we waited for the president. Then he was in a separate room. Then they walked us all in there. We stood in a line. And we were given 2 minutes to say hi and get a picture. And the president did what he always does. How do the Pirates look this year? You know, it's usually like, I think the Steelers are going to make it. He was right, by the way, about that with the playoffs last time. And, you know, I'm like, all right, I got to get two things in with him. And I'm just like, too early to tell. They got to sign McCutcheon. And next points. The one is, you know, CMU, Uber, a lot of talk right now Uber's hiring a lot of professors and scientists and researchers from Carnegie Mellon. And there's going to be a city in this country that is going to become the home of the autonomous vehicle. And it's going to be a city that has research facilities, the ability to do manufacturing, and the ability of a city government to open up streets in order to make it happen. I have a good relationship with Uber. I've had the opportunity to meet with their CEO. A lot of the battles that we had last year to open that type up. We have great research and everything that they need at Carnegie Mellon to make it happen, including the mapping and the software and everything else. We have Bombardier up in West Mifflin that builds these types of vehicles, not autonomous vehicles, but vehicles worldwide. We have a history of building things. We have everything. So why shouldn't the world's headquarters be Pittsburgh? And I just wanted to get it on the president's radar, even though he's not going to be able to do anything. And I met with the Department of Transportation, too, because when this decision gets made and we're competing against Boston or we're competing against Silicon Valley or we're competing against Detroit or everywhere else, I want a heads up on it. And I want the ability to be out of the gate first and being the city that can make it happen. And the second thing we talked about was district energy plans. You know, the idea that you build a huge power plant and you feed that power plant with fossil fuels and you burn all that fossil fuels and then hundreds of miles you create a line and it drips electricity till it comes to your kitchen and you turn on your blender is part of 19th century. 21st century energy policy will be localized. And everything from the building that you work in, like this one, will be producing its own energy. And then the excess energy that will need to be produced will be done in a local scale. So why not start now? Why wait? So as we're developing that 28 acres in the Hill District, I want to see that entire development done by producing energy on site. And we know we have all this natural gas, and it's not moving to Philadelphia, so it can be shipped around the world right now. Let's use that while we start working on the long-term plans for renewable energy. When we develop the El Mono site in Hazelwood, let's make that entire site off the grid. Let's do the same as we're developing out the Strip District. And we already have a steam plant in downtown and a steam plant on the north side. And how do we connect all of those so that we can create the largest contiguous area in the world off the grid of district direct energy? And so I talked to him about that, and he just, his eyes kind of lit up. And
This is the president.
Yeah, had the meeting the next day with his officials at the West Wing in the White House, and we talked about how to start working through the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy sitting on $40 billion that was part of the stimulus package that hasn't been spent. The president has 20 months left. I want a little bit of that.
You're saying we could use that here.
Yeah, and we can do it in working with Carnegie Mellon and Pitt and the Energy Innovation Center in the Hill District and all of these different parts. We have a Department of Energy right in South Park that can help us to put – we have all those pieces. So on those two big ideas, let's make Pittsburgh the world leader. Let's build the world headquarters for these types of things right here, and then let's see what happens. And we got 20 months under this administration to see if we can get some traction behind it.
Let's go to some of our tweets, and these aren't like the Jimmy Kimmel mean tweets. These are like he unleashed on President Obama last week. These are good inquisitive tweets.
Yes.
John on Twitter asks, can and will our mayor do anything to try and revitalize Pittsburgh neighborhoods like Arlington?
Yes. So one of the things I met at the White House about was the old St. Clair Village. Is it St. Clair Village? Yeah, St. Clair Village. Areas that we have that have a great opportunity.
Wally Jamal wrote a great play about St. Clair Village.
Really?
Yes, down at the Pittsburgh Playwrights. But anyway.
Well, okay, big, massive area, about 140 acres, 120 acres, sitting up with views of the city that has been basically nothing for over a decade. We had torn everything out, and it's sitting there. And we have a community plan that will incorporate all of the different changes of making it multifamily housing in an urban farm, in the largest urban farm, in the closest urban farm to a central business district. And as we look at doing that, we're also looking at Allentown and how we can reestablish Warrington Avenue. And as we're doing that, we're looking at Arlington and how these areas connect to the south side. in all of these communities that were built at one time, including Beltshoover and Knoxville, how they all can combine. And we put in an application with the federal government to be a part of a program that would give special emphasis to any federal grants coming in. And we added all those hilltop communities into that map.
Great, great question, John. Glad you brought that up. So, so definitely some interesting things happening there. We were going to get to the question of potholes. We might as well do that now. Nettie P on Twitter says, "How do you feel about mosaic-filled potholes?" I guess that's one way to fill them, but we definitely have a. I mean, it comes around this year at this time every year the pothole problem. Although I have to say that up in my neighborhood in the Bon Air area, you're seeing right down to the bricks,
yeah.
The old bricks that used to be there on the streets.
So first off, Nettie P, hello. Nettie not only writes tweets that are informative and funny sometimes, like this one I'm assuming, but also is somebody who provides good support when there's times that we need some good support. First on the potholes, later this afternoon, you're going to be able to see all the 2,000-plus calls that came in. We're going to put it out to the public with a map that shows it, and during the pothole blitz, what areas had the most complaints, where we were able to hit, where we still need to be able to hit, and at the same time, start to look at a macro of where we're having the most problems in the city with our streets. You know, it didn't just happen over the course of a couple of years. This is about a 10-year problem, and it's going to take about a decade to get our whole streets back. We're also, you know, what we're doing right now is temporary. Cold patch is only being used because the asphalt plants aren't open for another 4 weeks. But we're looking to bring in the only traveling asphalt plant in North America, looking over at Europe, and hopefully having it here before too long.
We're down to about the two-minute warning,
okay.
So I just want to give you that huge issue of vital importance. The Pittsburgh taco truck.
Yes. Delicious tacos.
Asks on Twitter, can we start talking about food truck legislative change, which was part of your platform, or is council still a barrier?
It's not a barrier. I mean, council, it still has to go through council approval, and the proper way of doing that is providing legislative change through council that then council votes on and it becomes part of the city code. However, I think Pittsburgh Taco Truck and all the other food trucks realize nobody's gotten ticketed. There is, you know, sometimes when there isn't a problem, addressing it and saying there is may cause a negative reaction. And what we've done is we've taken a hands-off approach until council brings up the legislation to allow our food truck industry to grow. The other thing, and what I've heard from other food truck operators, is the moment that we create a program that just opens the city up, then what is going to happen is these local trucks are going to go out of business because New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. mega operators are looking at Pittsburgh, and they will bring in their trucks and force the other ones out. We want to create a unique atmosphere for our food trucks while at the same time being able to give them the opportunity to succeed.
Well, just if you have a few seconds here, will city authorities also adopt the paid parental leave policy? That's Jason Phillips on Twitter.
Yeah, actually, Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak has sponsored that bill even before others were. And I'm scheduled to sign it. I did sign it. See, I'm here with Tim McNulty, who knows better than I what I'm signing. That's great. Thanks, Tim. Anything else I signed that I didn't realize?
As long as somebody knows.
Oh, Tim McNulty's pay raise. I signed as well.
Okay, 30 seconds here. 200th anniversary of Pittsburgh's incorporation. We've got the music.
Yes.
So you take us out. What are we going to do?
All right, Pittsburgh. So we're going to celebrate 200 years as a city. We're going to be bringing the National League of Cities in at the end of November to be able to celebrate with leaders from throughout the country. But we want to celebrate in your neighborhood. So you tell us what we want to do. We can't build a new city-county building, but we can sure have a good time for a full year.
Mayor Bill Peduto joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Happy 199th Pittsburgh. So long for now.